Hello friends, Sam Jackson Reed here, producer for this podcast. Jumping in again at the top of the episode to remind you that this is part two of our first conversation on Sudan, the Forgotten War. If you missed the first episode, go back down in our feed and you'll find it. This episode picks off right where the last one left off. So if you haven't heard that first one, you may be a little bit confused listening to this second episode. So go back, have a listen to that, and then jump in. And a reminder, if you have any questions that you would love our advocates to answer, then please do reach out to us on social media, send us your questions. We'll gather them all together for a special question and response episode later on down the line. For now, I'll hand you back over to Kiri and Darren for the second part of our conversation on Sudan, the Forgotten War.
Just rewinding a little bit, you mentioned bombings of churches and other buildings. I assume those would have been also places of sanctuary for people fleeing the violence.
Actually, in Khartoum, because most of the residents escaped Khartoum, but there were Sarah, can you remind me of your statements? Can you remember they were Christians in that churches?
There was, yeah. So I think part of the part of these violations are in the context of a war. So often we've had it reflected back to us that, oh, this isn't a war based on religion. It's not on sort of religious basis. But what we are observing is that they're, you know, targeting places of worship is a violation of international humanitarian law. And back in December, I believe, there was a church in Khartoum that was bombed by the SAF, and within the sort of the church building, within the church complex, there was a nursery. So at least I think 8 children were killed in this attack. And that's one of the dangers of, you know, the context of a conflict. But places of worship are places of sanctuary, or they're places where during the day, if it's an area of relative safety, you know, during the day, families might send their children to this nursery and try and be able to go out and working. And so indiscriminate attacks on places of worship, whether or not there is a religious motivation towards that, is so dangerous at this time, because there are so many people who are seeking shelter. Mahan had mentioned the church in Shendi. You know, about 100, at least 100 people had fled from this area in Khartoum that was bombed and fled to Shendi, and they had nowhere to stay, so they stayed in the church building. So in these cycles of displacement that we have mentioned, people will gather where there is community, and places of worship is often one of the first ports of call that people will go to, which makes it even more dangerous and even more alarming when we are documenting these attacks on places of worship.
I wanted to talk about how do you, and maybe you can help us learn how to respond, because everything we're talking about is so heavy on a human level. We're talking about people being internally displaced. We're talking about rape, famine, war, forced conversions. These things are so heavy. On one level, I understand why for many people it's easier to just tune it out, because to walk around with this reality can be sometimes a burden. So I'd like to ask each of you, how do you in your own personal life stay connected to the pain and the suffering that people are going through? And how do you move forward in the midst of that, and maybe help our listeners to not just be resigned from a place of powerlessness or disconnection, but to stay engaged without being overwhelmed?
Well, we carry on no matter what. We have been working in Sudan for like 2 decades, witnessed lots of violation, even though what's going on now is really beyond. But sometimes you feel like you have no options but to carry on. And I believe what we are doing, documenting these violations, these crimes, is something we must continue to do. It's heartbreaking, indeed. But to tell the world what's going on, you feel like you did a little bit of your part in awareness, in telling the people, and I believe those who are listening now, everyone feel like they want to do something. But what that I don't know. But I feel like I spread the word, and then anyone can do something to help. It's really heartbreaking. The couple of years ago, we had psychosocial support training for human rights defenders and who work in FOB before the war. It was heartbreaking listening to their stories. And we had another workshop after the war. And if you compare between this workshop, you feel how people are devastated and how people are traumatized in Sudan. It's generational traumatized and lost from with people for quite a long time. I leave it for Sarah to, sometimes I feel like I can't continue.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges in this work is sometimes knowing what to do. And I think for those of us who've been working on Sudan, as Mohammed said, for decades, I think back to 2019 when Bashir was taken out, when he was removed from power. And there was such a sense of elation. There was such a sense of joy, both for those who opposed him and it cost them something, but also for those who managed to navigate around his rule and his leadership. And I remember around Easter time, maybe just after Easter, there was a demonstration in the center of Khartoum. And the protesters, the civilians who had been peacefully coming out, primarily led by women, and standing up against this regime that had been in place for 30 years, and they were met with violence, they were met with bullets, but ultimately Bashir was removed. And this at this gathering, there was a sort of protest sit-in sort of site, and there was a stage, and people come up and make speeches. And the organizers of that specifically asked the Christians on the Sunday to come up and to share and to express their thoughts. I think that at one point they sang hymns. They almost led. I think they led a service there, and that was something that probably 6 months beforehand was unimaginable to have happened in the center of Khartoum. And I guess in what we read and what we're seeing, in the work that we do, we almost have to hold on to, maybe we call it prophetic imagination. Some people might call it absolute optimism against the face of what we're seeing. But I think we have to work towards a day where Sudan will be at peace itself, where people can come home, where the streets will be peaceful again, where people's homes are pieced back together. And we can't give in to despair. And I think as Mohammed has sort of was sort of saying there, in terms of you just feel so overwhelmed. And I'm it's difficult to think of what people who are in the country, in the context, are facing and are living with. But I think we just have to work towards doing whatever we can for there to be a future of peace, of hope, of freedom in Sudan, where the injustices that we see that sit under the surface, but the injustices that we also see in the violations that have come up through the war are not a reality.
Yeah, we carry on, as I said, and you just remind me of the sitting before the army headquarters, where people stayed there for months before ousting Bashir. But then after ousting Bashir, the RSF and SAF, where they were together, the Transition Military Council, they committed the massacre of June the 3rd. They killed hundreds of protesters, civilian protesters. They throw their bodies into the Nile, raped women in front of the headquarters, torturing people, detained them. And people disappeared from the sit-in. There were no more people. And RSF and SAF thought, okay, that's it. They thought it was over. And they now they can rule the country and to be the new dictator for more 30 years. And they acted like that for only three weeks. After 3 weeks, Sudan rose again. Millions of people everywhere, not only in the capital in Khartoum, everywhere, until they brought this military council down and forced them to accept what the civilian want. So that gives me hope that we are resilient, Sudanese people are resilient. And even with this devastation and with this heavy and overwhelming situation, I feel like we will come back again and people will continue.
Mohamed, in a previous conversation I had with you, you mentioned sometimes the only thing we can do is to cry. And I think there's something powerful about allowing ourselves to feel the weight and the impact of these abuses, the way that real humans are suffering. Can you talk a little bit about that and share with us how that has helped you as you advocate on behalf of those in need?
I grew up in a very conservative community where men are not allowed to cry. So you are not allowed to cry. You are a man. But I do cry. And I believe every single family, every single Sudanese family is crying every day and night, seeing our people in this situation. But sometimes when someone asks a question, you don't have an answer for this question. You feel like the only answer is just to cry. If you ask me why an adult, like a soldier or a fighter, rape a child less than 1 year old, how could I say? If you ask me why a woman was raped and after this was raped, was banned in front of her kids, I would just cry. This is really heavy. And this gives you like kind of relief. Couple of days ago, when the atrocities in Al-Fashir, it has been for ages, but the last 3 days was really heavy in Darfur. My little daughter made a small bag, like crochet bag, and she asked me to sell it and to send the money to the people there. She's 13 years old. I cried, but I felt the hope at the same time. I put the bag in an auction on the family group in WhatsApp. So far, I think it is like £30, the auction at £30, which is really good. So this show you the solidarity, even with our kids, we feel each other and we continue.
Beautiful. That's so moving to hear about your daughter who wanted to do something. And I think that's such a hopeful response that each of us can do something. That's our hope with this podcast. Yes, to share the weight of what's happening, to raise awareness, but also to inspire action, to inspire movement, to say that each of us has something. And so, Mohamed, thank you for sharing that beautiful story of what your daughter was able to do. And that certainly touches me to hear that.
Yeah, incredible to hear just how moved a young girl is to respond to the needs of others. And I think you asked the question, Darren, of where do I find hope? I think I find hope in our shared humanity, in the stories of people who online you see fundraising £3,000 to get a family to get medical treatment. The Sudanese, a relative needs medical treatment and needs to travel from this city to another city. and just bearing witness to that shared humanity, bearing witness to people coming together and saying, you know, I might not be able to pull together a UN conference that sanctions the United Arab Emirates, but I can do this small thing. I can come around, you know, my Sudanese neighbors. I can support a family or support some friends. And that's the thing that brings inspiration. I think also in our work, by documenting and telling the stories of those that we work with and are sort of connected to, and sharing them with the UN bodies who can then take that information and do something with it, with the African Union that's investigating aspects and crimes that have been committed. It's, you know, trying to schedule meetings with those who have the power to make a difference, and to try and tell them about what's going on here, the communities, the families, the people who we're connected to. That gives me hope.
I think you've both shared so eloquently. Thank you. Not just about the scale of this crisis, but also how on every level, whether it's the macro, international, big state level, or just on that human level, one-to-one, how we can make a difference. But I think the first step definitely is to listen and to care and allow ourselves to step in and to feel and to hear and to share what is going on. I'm also struck by the resilience of the Sudanese people. We shouldn't ask them to be this, but I'm struck by how, in a nation that has seen so much turmoil even before this devastating crisis, the people have risen up again and again to demand better, to demand the future that they want for themselves. So I sincerely hope that when the big powers do gather, that civilians also get a seat at that table, the voice that matters the most. I think as we close, some of the phrases that you've said that really stuck with me include that about what you said, Sarah, about prophetic imagination. And Darren, I know you want to say more on that.
Yeah, Sarah, that phrase stuck with me as well, prophetic imagination. It's often in times of crisis that I personally find a lot of comfort and solace from the prophets, because they were often writing in the midst of crises, chaos, war, and they called the people towards a vision of hope. And I want to end with this particular passage from Isaiah 2. As you mentioned at the beginning, Sudan used to be known as the breadbasket of Africa. And it strikes me that the way that war decimates the land and the people is not the way it has to be forever. And Isaiah says, "He will judge between nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore." And this is a prophetic imagination of what happens when the kingdom of God comes in its fullness. And that's our ultimate hope. And that's what we are striving for and working for together as we seek to raise awareness, seek to advocate, and seek to be a part of the process of moving towards peace and hope and restoration. And our desire is that this conversation is a beginning point on that journey for our listeners as we work together, as we advocate together, as we raise awareness and find ways to take action. So Mohamed and Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to continuing the conversation, to dig in deeper, to understand the roots, but also to understand the path forward. And I appreciate you sharing your experiences, your journey, and your hope with us. And may we continue to hold on to that hope as we progress in these conversations together.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was heavy. I'm so grateful to have the conversation with Sarah and Mohanad. On a personal human level, I still feel the weight of what was discussed, and personally feel that tension of learning more about this invites pain. It invites moving into areas that feel very uncomfortable. And so for our listeners, thank you for hanging with us in this conversation. I think part of understanding the context helps us to see where to move forward. But yeah, for me, just on a personal level, it was heavy. How about you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm a new mom, so especially hearing, yes, just all the crimes underway, the severity of them, the unimaginable horror. I think that really stayed with me. But it was a reminder too that bearing witness is so important. As Mohanad had said at one point, we've got to press on, and that we have to stay with this and walk through it. Not least because at the end of that, that's also to ultimately securing justice, documentation, the bearing witness. That's what the advocates are doing. And we as the audience, this podcast, we as people who aren't maybe involved in that immediate advocacy work, walking with these stories, holding them in our hearts, raising awareness of what's going on. This cannot remain the forgotten war in light of all that we've heard.
I think when we hear a word like solidarity, it can be exciting, motivating, inspiring. My experience of talking with people and being in countries where people are experiencing injustice because of their religion or belief is that solidarity can also be a painful experience, because you have to feel with, you have to have that compassion, or you're invited to have that. And I just want to create space for that, for our listeners to feel, and that's actually good. Jesus reminds us, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. It helps us to feel the weight of the brokenness of the world, and to have a discontent that says this shall not remain. We are not okay with the status quo. We want to see change, and hopefully that sense of feeling can motivate us to action. I was also impacted by the phrase that Mohanad talked about, specifically Forbes issues around this, is a crisis within a crisis. And we'll hope to unpack that in future conversations, specifically how people are in the midst of this conflict being targeted, particularly because of their faith. And that creates a unique challenge for people of faith to be living in the midst of this. So we want to make sure within this so-called forgotten war that the people on the ground themselves are not forgotten, and particularly those seeking their best to maintain their faith in the midst of such a difficult conflict. The goal of our conversations are to provide hope, to provide a path forward, and to realize that while none of us can do this on our own, together we do make a difference, both from the ground up on that personal, interpersonal level of providing support, encouragement, aid, psychosocial trauma, relief, and support, but also from the top down. And CSW advocates in the highest halls of power around the world to ensure that these voices are heard. So we do make a difference. We do need each other. And journeying through these topics, while uncomfortable, heavy, and painful, is necessary for us together to seek justice, to seek hope, and to seek peace.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation about Sudan as part of our Spotlight series. We'll be back again next week with another conversation diving deeper and deeper into the issues of this complex and heartbreaking conflict. CSW is a Christian human rights organization advocating for freedom of religion or belief. As Christians, we stand with everyone facing injustice because of their religion or belief. Our work, including this podcast, exists because of the generosity of our supporters, just like you. If you're interested in finding out more or making a donation, go to csw.org.uk. You can also help us grow this work by sharing with your friends or leaving a 5-star review in whichever podcast catcher you're currently listening on. The CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series is hosted by Darren Adwalpoker and Kiri Kankwende. It's produced by Samuel Jackson Reed, and our theme music is Coriolis by Sizgi, made possible thanks to Artlist.io. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.